The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRV Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Steve Beauvais.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve Beauvais.
Welcome to the Money Talk Show with Steve Beauvais and Nathan Beauvais on Wednesday nights. He's my historian friend, son of mine as well, and the latest team to the Money Talk, latest member to the Money Talk team. And Wednesday nights is usually history night. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit about history of taxes. Of course, taxes is one of the more current issues right now. So for the, many of you are not probably aware of the basics of what's being proposed, and we'll begin with some of that. And talk about some of the hearsay out there about the pros and cons to what's being proposed. The basic concept, for those of you who are not nerdy at all, for some people believe that when you lower taxes, it increases activity. A person who has a four-unit apartment building they've owned for 30 years, and if they sell it and the tax bill is $140,000, they may not sell it. They just leave it to the kids, the next generation. It's too big a bill, you know. But if all of a sudden the taxes are $86,000 to sell it, maybe they will. So lower taxes, some believe, I'm one of them, that it increases activity, and activity increases profitability and so on and so on. But you can't go too far with it. You know, we need a good tax base, we need a good liquidity, and we need to get rid of debt in this country, in my opinion, and our lives as well. So, hey, congratulations. I think this week we're celebrating the day 25 years of Dave Ramsey on the air. I've been listening. I'm a big fan, of course. Past the point in my personal development to need the practices, because I did them when I was younger. But those of you who have children, and children can be as old as mine, who's here in his 30s. But he's a financial guy, too, so he knows that stuff. Dave Ramsey, Financial Peace University, I think a great gift for young people starting their life to learn how to handle money in a responsible way will save you a lot of grief and a lot of frustration, I think, in the long run. Markets were all up slightly today, up 50, 60, 70 points. You know, pretty much the same old, steady trudge up. Many of you have heard the long-term adage that the market climbs a wall of worry. And it often does. You know, I'm talking to clients right now, and I talked to a couple on the phone today. They're very nervous the things they're hearing in the world today. I'm nervous. But it's very very tempting at times. There always seems to be a reason to not be an investor because it's a little bit scary, and it always is. That's why the returns are better than guaranteed investments, because it is can be worrisome. If you are well-diversified and long-term, you don't need to do too much, I don't think. But I would not speculate at a time like this. I've been saying this for a while. I think markets are fairly priced, and the only time I think we should speculate is if we think something is on sale, and I definitely don't believe that U.S. stocks are on sale, so I would be careful if you are a short-termer. Nathan, taxes is the hot topic right now, of course.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Our president is proposing to lower the tax on businesses, which the idea is that would stimulate market growth, you know, new employees, better benefits for those that are there, higher wages, you know, and all that. And to some extent, that probably will happen. There will also be some small company somewhere where the tax savings, the owner just took it home. That'll happen too.
Yeah, of course. But when you look at how many businesses there are, how many small businesses, and there's going to be, certainly on the other side of the coin, too, there's going to be people who are going to take those profits and reinvest them and expand the business and hire some more employees.
Majority, I believe, will do it that way. Majority.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Depends on your age, too. If you're 73 at that point, you know, you're thinking a little differently about what to do, right?
Yeah. If you remember, I think it was 3 or 4 months ago, it was only a couple months after the president was inaugurated, he came out with a very brief one-page plan on taxes. It was very, very brief. So today he's come out, the administration's put out a new document that elaborates a little bit more. It's still lacking some details that I'd like to see, but you know, that's still a long way to go. It's obviously an incredibly complicated undertaking, but some of the things that are being proposed in the new tax proposals are, for example, increasing the standard deduction. So currently, married couples filing jointly have about just over 6,000 standard deduction. That would almost be doubled to $24,000 for married taxpayers filing jointly. That's the proposal the president is putting forward.
Wow.
So that basically means the first $24,000 of your income is not going to be taxed. And he is calling this a quote-unquote zero tax bracket, although there is no technically
zero. And then if that same couple had mortgage deductions for a house,
yes,
they could have $40,000 of income and not pay taxes.
Right. So the interest, they want to keep the interest, home mortgage deductions, chattel deductions. But one thing that I think they're talking about getting rid of is if people who itemize their deductions, so that, in other words, they're not using the standard deduction, they're itemizing, they can use the money that they spend on state income taxes that's usually deductible as an itemized item. Again, only about 30% of taxpayers itemize their deductions, so it doesn't apply to the majority of people. But they're talking about getting rid of that. So you could no longer deduct your federal income, your income for federal income tax purposes, with the state income you paid. Not all states pay income tax. So obviously, we're in Rhode Island, so let's talk about Rhode Island.
Why should you pay tax on money you didn't get to keep? That's crazy, man. Crazy.
So in Rhode Island, the highest, there are three brackets in Rhode Island. The lowest is 3.75. For married filing jointly, it's 0 to 60,000, roughly 60,000, and then 4.75 from 60 to 137, and anything over 137,000 in Rhode Island is taxed at 6% for state income tax. So in Rhode Island, if you itemize your deductions, which I'm not sure if you do,
Yes.
I'm sure you probably itemize on your
state taxes.
Right,
because you couldn't be taxed on money you don't have. It's already been taken for another tax bill.
Yeah.
That's why it should be deductible. Of course it should
be. Well, that will no longer be deductible.
Right, gotcha.
is what they're proposing. And some analysts are predicting that could equal $1 trillion in revenue over 10 years.
I hope that the benefit is focused on the middle class. I think that's what we need now in the world.
Yeah.
A lot of what we're saying here with the exemptions being higher, that's going to help a lot of people earn under $24,000.
Well, the standard deduction, like you said, is going to be raised. But there also talks about eliminating exemptions. So if you have lots of children, let's say you've got five children, that's not going to benefit you as much as it would benefit someone with only one child, for example.
Should be per child, per dependent.
Well, again, the final details are not out yet, but these are two things that they're proposing, getting rid of exemptions and doubling the standard deduction. And then, of course, the elimination of the SALT, state and local tax deduction, is another one that they're getting rid of. They're also proposing a 25% rate for pass-through income. So most of the income in the for businesses are pass-through.
Small ones, especially.
Only 5% now of businesses are C corporations.
Right. That they file a separate return or a separate entity.
Right. So currently, if you are a sole proprietor or a partnership, your income is taxed at your personal rate, and you don't have there's no business or corporate tax rate for you. So what the president is proposing is a new tax rate of 25% for pass-through income, and no longer at your personal rate. So
if a person was in the maximum, that could be 39. They could go from 39 to 25 on some of that. That could be 14%
It could
be quite a savings.
Yeah, huge savings.
That would be a middle upper class, I would think, would benefit from that.
Upper. Yeah. Certainly, yeah. So
I love that high exemption thing on the bottom, because if a person is a simple person and wants to live low and simply, they can pay very little to no tax at all.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the median income in America is $55,000.
Household
median household income.
Right.
So
if you got 24 plus a mortgage
deduction,
almost
half of your income is not going to be taxable.
Plus a mortgage deduction interest.
Yeah.
Most people, maybe not that income level, they might not own though.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, it's probably going to come down to case by case, situation by situation. You know, that the not being able to claim the state taxes. I mean, in some states like California, for example.
But they're probably 10% when we're 6.
I just had it here. States with the highest. So California is the highest, 13.3.
Oh, give everything away, that's what happens.
Marginal tax break. Oregon, 10%. Minnesota, 10%. Sure. Iowa, 9. New Jersey, 9. Vermont, 9.
Nice place to surf, bad place to pay taxes.
Yes. California. So if you're in that state, and you're an upper income, if you're in the, you know, if you're itemizing and paying, I mean, that's going to be a huge
top people like professional golfers will move based on tax law changes like this. It can be state to state, enormous differences.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. Athletes, pro football players, people like that, you know.
Yeah, well, what's kind of ironic is that I'm looking at a report on Bloomberg right now that shows the average state and local taxes deduction by congressional district. And so IRS data from 2015 shows the average household deduction for state and local taxes in districts in Democratic districts was $4,433. The average for Republican districts was $2,896. Hmm. So significantly higher in the Democratic districts, those that pay. Of course, a lot of Republican districts don't even charge. They don't have a state income tax.
Right. Just a different way of running the ship. That's all. More benefits and higher cost. That's
exactly,
all.
Exactly, right.
Companies are run that way too, right? Companies are different, just like states are different as far as how they define what is generosity and providing for their people. And everybody has a little different definition of it. That's why it's confusing like this.
Absolutely.
This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, a station for talk and business. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. And check out the podcasts available at 790business.com. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talk and business. Hey, congratulations to the Dave Ramsey Show. 25 years on the air. We're close. We're in that range. When the man's around, he knows the date exactly.
I think it's 26.
I'm trying to be humble. Don't get in my way. Anyway, congratulations to Dave Ramsey. Again, our audience tends to be anyone who's interested in investments and growing wealth. We don't talk a lot about debt and things because it's a little bit different stage of life program, I think. We'd be happy to talk about those things, and we have covered those things in the past. Dave really goes after those topics, and boy, does he know them cold. What your rights are as a creditor. I haven't had a credit card balance in 20 years. I'm clueless. I have no idea what the rules are about if somebody's harassing you over a credit card. Although I did have an experience over the past 20 years with a local guy with the same name as me, first name spelled a little differently. And I've had actually sheriffs at my door with a summons to bring me into court for unpaid credit card bills and things that aren't mine. Eventually, I get tired of them, and I get my lawyer to shove them around and prove to them that it's not me, and they leave me alone for 2 or 3 years. Then they come out of the woodwork again. It's been going on for 15 years, and every time I get a call, the new credit company says, after I tell them to tune into my radio show, and it's not me, I've never had a Sears credit card in my life, they pause and say, well, Mr. Bove, if you're going to continue to dodge your responsibilities, we're going to have to get rough with you. And I say, well, I'll be in the parking lot in 5 minutes, and no one shows up. But again, if you have questions regarding debt and those sort of things, we'd be happy to help you here as well. But, I mean, the purebred beast of the age 20 to 45 is the Dave Ramsey Show. Watch your debt, live within your means. These are all basic fundamentals that will make you the best clients that we ever had, actually, along the journey. Nathan, taxes. This is what's hottest right now, so we're on it.
Yeah, so the White House put out a press release today, outlining in more detail the president's framework for taxes. And as far as individual tax rate structure, it says this: under current law, taxable income is subject to 7 tax brackets. The framework aims to consolidate the 7 tax brackets into 3 brackets of 12%, 25%, and 35%. Typical families in the existing 10% bracket are expected to be better off under the framework due to the larger standard deduction, larger child tax credit, and additional tax relief that will be included during the committee process. So like we talked about in the last segment, they want to double the standard deduction essentially to $24,000 for married couples. They're proposing raising the lowest tax bracket from 10 to 12, but if you are marriage finally joining, you can deduct the first $24,000 of income. So you probably would be better off. It gets complicated.
Sounds like about half, like you said, half of the average household income in America. Pretty close.
Yes.
Close.
Right. Yeah, close. They are proposing eliminating, I'll read on here, an additional top rate may apply to the highest income taxpayers to ensure that the reform tax code is at least as progressive as the existing tax code and does not shift the burden from high income to lower and middle income taxpayers. So essentially what they're saying is that they're proposing three brackets here, but they're leaving the door open to Congress to adding a fourth higher bracket for upper, way higher incomes.
Yeah. From Mighty Tom.
Yeah, exactly. From Mighty Tom, Mighty Tom and Giselle.
Mighty right. Tom Brady tax bracket.
Yeah.
Look, let me tell you what. If you make $50 million a year and your wife makes $100 million a year, no matter how much you pay in taxes, nobody is going to care.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, you're not going to get any sympathy from anybody.
No.
Don't tell your pals over a beer about your tax bracket because you're not going to get any sympathy.
It goes on to say, to further simplify the tax filing and provide tax relief from middle-income families, the framework repeals their personal exemptions for dependents and significantly increases the child tax credit. The first $1,000 of credit will be refundable as under current law. In addition, the framework will increase the income levels at which the child tax credit begins to phase out. Currently, today, it's $55,000 for married couples filing jointly. The modified income limits will make the credit available to more middle-income families and eliminate the marriage penalty in the existing credit.
Keep in mind, listeners out there, when Nathan talks about a tax credit, for the average listener right now, a tax credit is four times more valuable than a tax deduction.
Exactly. Right. That it pays the tax for you. Right.
Pays the bill.
Right.
Where a $1,000 tax deduction is actually an income deduction. We all say that wrong. We've all been trained to do that wrong.
Yeah.
But a tax credit comes right off, like when you buy an energy efficient new refrigerator, you might get a tax credit. That comes right off your tax bill, right at the bottom line. And is four times for average people more powerful a tax credit is than a tax deduction.
That's correct. The framework also provides a non-refundable credit of $500 for non-child dependents to help defray the cost of caring for other dependents. So I think they're looking at the situations right now with the baby boomers getting older, our population is getting older, and a lot of older children, maybe people like your age, caring for their parents, people living longer, but not able to take care of themselves, unfortunately. So this is a new piece of legislation they're trying to put in that would give you a credit for a non-child dependents, being like an elderly parent, for example. But they're very kind of vague on when they say significantly increase the child tax credit, they're a little vague on what that means. They don't give any specifics. They also don't give any specifics when it comes to what are the barriers for the brackets. So we have no idea on that as well.
May I intervene?
Just go for it. Yeah.
Shoot in here. One of the things, you've heard this now in your tenure with us, many people talk about retiring and being in a lower tax bracket. That was the case when I started in the business. I think there was something like 20 brackets, or 12 to 20.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Well, wait till next segment. We'll talk about when it was like 50 brackets.
Was it at one time?
Yeah.
Okay, I remember that. And that's where that adage came from. But I'm here to tell everyone that's listening, the odds are extremely high that you will work and retire in the same tax bracket.
Oh, yeah.
You will not be in a lower bracket when you retire. It may happen to you. It depends on where your income lies and the scale, you know. But right now, the married filing jointly, I'm just guessing at it. You may have it right there. What is, if you have it, pull it out.
Yeah, married filing jointly, joint returns currently right now.
60 to like 160 is
it
one
is,
one bracket?
$75,900 to $153,000.
Okay, that's a lot.
It's the 25% bracket.
So you could be making $140,000 and drop to $79,000. You're in the same bracket.
Correct.
When your income went down $60,000, you're still in the same tax bracket.
Correct. And if this framework that they're talking about goes through, it's even more likely that you retire in the same bracket, because
there
will be three brackets.
Right. So I think if anyone is listening right now, I believe it is, in today's world, it is not appropriate and probably a little dangerous for you to believe that you'll be in a lower tax bracket when you retire. The odds are very high you will not be.
Yes.
All right. And as crazy as that might sound, folks, you have to trust us on this one, because we can't show you. If we had a television show, we could put up all kinds of super nerd charts and things. Energy prices, had a big tumble the last month here. The prices have rebounded quite nicely there. We talked about possibly looking at energy. IGE was an ETF we talked about a little bit. That's up about 8%, believe it or not, in a month. And what's Exxon Mobil? XOM, I believe, is the symbol for Exxon Mobil. Yeah. But similar. Energy stocks rebounding nicely with nice dividends to pay as well. People don't realize that ExxonMobil has a dividend of almost 4%. That's pretty amazing considering, I mean, that's, some people tell me that they'd be happy with that return on their money, 4% on their money would be make them happy. And the dividend alone will do that, you know. Individual stocks are tricky. Most of you should stay away from them. If you have an itch to scratch and you can't resist, look into the new world of exchange-traded funds. Very cost-effective, small minimums, no hotshot manager being paid billions. Just a great way to participate in our economy, whether the S&P 500 index is a great one. You can look at international ones, whatever you want to look at. But I would recommend, highly recommend that for most people who are beginners rather than individual stocks.
I would think so, yeah, because you can diversify so easily.
Yeah, yeah.
Just by purchasing that one basket.
How much time we have left, Chief? 2 minutes? Time for a quick advisor story, one I love to tell.
Yep.
I actually hate to tell this story.
One you love to hate.
Yeah. This is 10 years ago, probably. Nice lady came in the office to see me. And long story short, she puts a statement in front of me, and it's an IRA that she has. And I noticed that it says beneficiary IRA, which means she inherited it from somebody, right? And it had $95,000 of value in it. And she said, what do you think of this, young man? And I said to her, well, this is a good start. How old are you? What else do you have? Do you have a pension? What about social? I started, And I said, is this what you have for retirement? She says, yes. She said, what's the value on that statement? I said, $92,000. She looked at me with the saddest look, and she said it was $900,000 a year ago. Her husband had worked for the company for 50 years, was an executive, got over-enamored with the stock, thought it was infallible, and he had all $900,000 of his 401k plan in company stock. He died.
Heartburn just listening to it.
He died. She inherited it, never changed it, and watched the value go from $900,000 to $90,000. She lost $810,000. And I said to her, she said, what could have been done to stop this? I said, you come in being my client, because when you came in the door, if I would have said to you, we can't hold any more than 10% of the value of the account in any one stock. That's a diversification requirement that I have as an advisor. And also for liability for her and I. Had she then said, no, Mr. Bove, I want to hire you to be my advisor. I want to keep this account just the way it is. I would have said, no, I'm not taking it under any circumstances unless it's changed. So my own concern about my own liability professionally would have saved her from that. And this is why these rules are there, folks. Don't put everything in one. The things you've heard don't do, don't do. This is the Money Talk Show, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show. I've been chomping at the bit all day to share this one with you all. About a week ago, I ordered a copy of an annuity that a client showed me. A copy of the... Nathan's laughing already. You're going to love this one, folks, unless you love annuities. I don't know why you would, but anyway. So I got a copy of this annuity. I'm 40 years experienced and with some pretty heavy credentials I won't toot about. Nathan's a very smart young man, educated as well, a good number of years experience as well, more currently educated on the topic than I. I read through how the death benefit is calculated for the client. As they die, they get more than if they cash out. That's one of the advantages of annuities. They're a hybrid. And so the client asked, what is the death benefit? And I could read that off a report. That was easy. When she said, how is it calculated? I spent, he's laughing again before I even get to him. I spent a half hour reading it. Now remember who I am, folks, okay? Again, I don't want to toot this too hard, but I've been doing this for 40 years. I gave up. I gave it to the young man thinking I'm too old. He put it back on my desk and said, are you crazy? Nobody can understand this.
Yeah.
Now, how can this stuff be sold when myself, one of the top financial planners in the region, I think, by credentials, and this very sharp, highly educated young man in the same field, he and I together read it over and over and over and over again. I said to him, how could you ever explain this to a customer? He said, you can't.
No way.
Impossible.
No way.
And if anybody thinks they can do it, I would love to hear him try. because there's no way anybody that owns this stuff knows what they have. This is why they're being squeezed. This is why they're being frowned upon. That's why, and they're changing a lot. Now, there are people who sell these things correctly, and they have a place. Yeah. But all too often, we run into them, as always, to put the fire out when they were sold wrong and people are angry.
Right.
That's why we feel the way we do. But they can be done correctly. Annuities aren't always wrong. They're just, in my opinion, mostly always wrong.
Right.
I'm like that guy Ken Fisher, in case you're curious about this.
Okay. What's his famous saying?
I said something about he'd rather go to hell than sell annuities. That's me. I'm with him, man.
Okay.
Now, many years ago, when the tax laws were different, I have clients that have annuities that I recommended to them 26 years ago.
Yeah.
You don't bust it out of the annuity now and pay all the taxes because there's a little better product available.
Right.
You just say 20 years ago, don't put any more in this. We think there's better choices, and we just move forward with the dollars. We don't churn them around because it's expensive for the client. And usually they get a big fat 1099 if you want to bust out and no more annuity. If you've had annuities for years, that's not the best advice.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best advice is don't put any more new money into them and then manage the ones you have as best you can.
I think you find that people who have a lot of money, a lot of income, who maybe don't have – who are self-employed – and phase out of traditional 401k stuff, you can get a tax deferral on a variable annuity.
Right.
There's no income limits at all.
No, there isn't. There's not
a variable annuity.
Right. But let me ask you this question, because we've never done this before, with you and I both having the knowledge now.
Yeah.
If you with a regular annuity, if you make that investment, you forfeited stepped-up basis on the investment to your family when you die, right?
Right, and because your net worth is, we're talking about high net worth people, they're probably going to be in a situation where they're...
Absolutely. You forfeit a stepped-up basis, you forfeited qualified dividends and capital gains treatment. And you pushed all the gains out till the final end to be taxed at the highest possible tax rate, ordinary income.
No, I agree.
Why is this good?
I don't know.
I don't get it. We don't get it. We're not going to get it. Stop trying to tell us that this stuff is good. We don't get it.
Yeah.
This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talking business. Annuities are a tool. When used properly, they're fine. They're just often used incorrectly as we see them the way. Again, have some friends and colleagues along the way who liked annuities, and we've kidded about it. They knew that I was strong feelings. I don't recommend them at all, but I think a proper allocation of them is not inappropriate for certain circumstances. It's not always wrong. Don't take it the wrong way. But we have to respond to the ones that land on our desk, and it's always people very upset and unhappy with finding out they don't have what they were told that they have. Just very confusing. Maybe there's no one to blame. Maybe it's just too confusing. If you and I looked at it like that and couldn't even come close.
No, I have no idea.
Then I don't know what to say about it. I have nothing to say.
No.
If anybody wants to challenge me and say that's because I'm not smart enough, I'm willing to take that battle on right now if you want to go there. But I honestly had terrible difficulty understanding the terms. There was probably in one paragraph three or four terms I didn't even know what they meant.
Well, it's lawyer jargon. That's the best way I could put it.
Yeah, well
it's
said.
It's just lawyer jargon.
Well said. Yeah.
And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't. I'm not gonna. Like,
the best thing an annuity does is give you a guaranteed life income because nothing else in the world can do it. So if you're going to use it for that purpose, I'm open to it as a tool.
You mean like an immediate annuity?
Yeah, right. You know I talk about it quite often. Matter of fact, I believe you'll hear us talk more and more about this thing called an immediate annuity over the next 2 or 3 years when rates become reasonable. They become reasonable, in my opinion. The reason I wasn't for them over the last few years was rates were at the lowest in history, and you're locking in that rate on that product for the rest of your life.
Correct.
And you don't want to do that when rates are the lowest in history. That's when you want to lock in debt and mortgages.
Immediate annuities work a lot like long-term bonds. You don't want to
bingo.
You don't want to buy them when the interest rates are really low.
Well said, because you'll suffer that low rate of return forever on that. And if you wait a little bit longer, you'll find they'll go up. We're going to do a little research on that to see how they increase. Right now, a 65-year-old with $100,000, can get about $500 or $600 a month.
Yeah,
guaranteed as long as they live.
Yep, that's the numbers I was looking at.
Yeah. What if someone has no one to leave the money to? A single successful single person just wants a guaranteed check in the mail every month. I don't want any hassles. Don't want to talk to that confusing investment guy.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to listen to that silly radio show. Those nerds, right? There are people who feel this way. Nothing wrong with
it. Absolutely,
they're just not interested in this stuff at all.
Right.
And if they could just get a guaranteed paycheck every single week, can't outlive it. Nothing can ever go wrong. That's the path they would probably choose.
Yeah.
Most don't, because the big drawback to annuities, unless you pay an extra fee, which I don't believe in, your principal is really gone. There's no estate value once you make the purchase. There's ways you can give up more interest and get it back, but you have to pay a fee to get your money back, which I never kind of sat well with me.
No.
Again, not always wrong, just we bump into them when it seems to be wrong, which is why we're being called in to take a look at them. This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, a station for talk and business. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790.
Hey, I got a question for you. We were talking about income taxes tonight, right, with the new proposal from the Trump administration. When was the first federal income tax in America implemented?
1890.
No, I got to go a little soon. Close. Close. 1913.
You know, that's the tax return I talk about all the time.
Yeah, the first
That
one.
Was the first year. I didn't know that. I just thought it was an old one.
It was, 1913, or maybe 1912. It was 1912, 1913, right around then. Yep.
Shipwreck was tax deductible. Right on the 1040. Shipwreck. Imagine
now,
that.
The United States actually had...
See, history can be fun, folks. See, you didn't think so, right?
The United States had different incarnations of income tax, federal income tax, but it was never permanent. It was always temporary to fund either the Civil War. There was one... But there was the first peacetime income tax was in 1894, but it didn't last. The Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional, had to get rid of it. So it really was federal income tax was severely unconstitutional, and it was Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4. For those of you listening at home, following along with your Constitution, your pocket Constitution in your pocket, it's quoted as saying, "No direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census of enumeration." Now, what this means is that if you're going to have a poll tax or a head tax, as they called it back then, it had to be based on the number of people living in the state. So the state that had the most people in it had to pay the most. It had to be in proportionate to the amount of people in the state.
Versus like geographic area.
Right, or versus income.
Or income.
So you could have a situation where you have the state of, let's just say, Rhode Island, right, who has much higher income than the state of Delaware, which has more people living in it. So Delaware had to pay more in taxes, even though there were more income being made in Rhode Island. Right. It made it really politically tough to do.
Yeah.
So we had to pass the 16th Amendment. The 16th Amendment to the Constitution allows for a federal income tax. I mean, it was clearly...
To even it out.
Clearly, the founding fathers who wrote the Constitution did not want a federal income tax or a head tax or poll tax.
You could have states empty if the tax rates next door are that much lower.
Yeah.
It's empty right out.
Yeah.
Right?
So
that's why it's not good. We need federal.
It made it really difficult, and that's why they had to do that in the early 1900s, pass that amendment. You could imagine the turmoil and the unrest in society at that point. I mean, think about it. I mean, we're talking about lowering the tax rate now, but imagine being living in that time period where now we're going to start, the federal government's going to come in and start taking money out of your check for the first time. I mean, that must have been a pretty turbulent time politically, I would think, you know.
In the streets, rioting.
But there was Democrats all supported the idea, and there was this progressive Republican, as they called them back then. Today it sounds like an oxymoron, but back then they were known as progressive Republicans. It was like Teddy Roosevelt, William Taft. Those types of guys considered themselves progressive Republicans. And the tax was supported by much of the South and the North Central states, but heavily opposed by the Northeast and the West. Senator Nelson Aldrich from Rhode Island, you may recognize that name, the Aldrich Mansion on Walrick Neck.
A mighty name, Aldrich.
Yes, he was originally opposed to any kind of federal income tax, but eventually came around and supported the 16th Amendment, which led to, again, like I said, the very first income tax. When we come back from the break, we're up against it right now. Talk a little bit about why did the federal government have to do this? What was the reasoning for putting a federal income tax in?
They hate us.
They hated us.
We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Yeah. 790, your station for talk and business. History night on the program. We're talking about a little bit about the history of taxes, but, you know, we have to talk about taxes now, probably more than history tonight.
Yeah.
We're talking about what's being proposed and what might happen.
Right. But before we went to that break, we were talking about why did the government impose a federal income tax.
They didn't hate us.
Well, in February of 1913, 3/4 of the states ratified the 16th Amendment, which allowed a federal income tax. New Hampshire, Vermont, Rhode Island, Massachusetts all never ratified the amendment. They all vehemently opposed to the federal income tax, Rhode Island was.
Right.
And the Bureau of Internal Revenue established a personal income tax division, 30 employees
Wow.
that had in 1913. How many today?
Millions.
30,000?
I don't know.
300,000?
An awful lot. Yeah, yeah. It's complicated. We definitely need to make it simpler.
Right. Well, the government was getting huge back then. It was trying to compete with other imperial nations. Japan, Germany, Britain, and other European powers were developing new technologies when it came to warfare. The Germans were developing submarines at a rapid pace. And the government looked and said, hey, we need to compete with these people, and we need income. How are they doing it? Well, they had a federal income tax. All the European countries had federal income taxes by then. So it really was a way for the government to compete and stay on par with the other nations.
The people of this country ran away from countries because of taxation. It was like the number one pet peeve.
Yeah.
Right? They didn't want to go reinstate it here. They tried to get away from it. But you can't run a real country without a tax base.
No, you can't.
You can't.
I mean, and the U.S. was expanding at that time, too. I mean, yeah. The Spanish-American War happened in 1898. Cuban independence happened at that time. The United States set up in Guantanamo Bay. The Philippines was an American territory until 1946. Puerto Rico was acquired during this time period. Guam, Hawaii, Alaska, the Panama Canal, all these territories were acquired by the United States government. And if you want to utilize them and do things with them, I mean, that takes money to do all these things. So that was one of the reasons you started to see, I think, the federal income tax, but mostly to compete with the other industrial nations, you know, to compete with their military projects. We talked about this in the earlier segment. The number of tax brackets was a lot higher in the past. In 1917, there were 21 brackets.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember many. I don't remember how many, but I remember there was a lot.
Yeah. But 1917 was the first major tax increase. It was during World War I. The top marginal rate went from 15% to 67%.
Whoa.
Yep. The top rate would reach as high as 73% in 1920. The bottom 2% bracket moved down from $20,000 to $2,000. But the federal revenues grew dramatically during this period. The average collection for each year in the 12 years preceding 1915 was $281 million per year. For the 12 years between 1915 and 1926, the average was $2.78 billion. That's a 10-fold increase in revenues per year.
10 banger.
From the federal income tax, yeah.
Wow.
In 1917, the IRS employed 524 headquarters staff and about 4,500 field staff. By 1918, the total staff had grown to 9,600. It also further rose to roughly 14,000, 18,000, 20,000, 21,000 subsequent years, really becoming a big organization. 1920s rates declined throughout. The top rate fell to 25%. We were done with World War I, so many politicians and citizens alike demanded the taxes come down. We were no longer at war. And it was the Roaring Twenties, baby, you know, jazz and... And what do they call it? Booze, underground booze, right? Prohibition was going on, you know. So
that's
it was,
right.
It was a lot of partying going on.
People want to drink.
Yeah, I often said.
Try to stop them. Look out.
The most important thing FDR ever did was remove prohibition.
Well, he realized he wasn't stopping anything.
No, right.
People
yeah,
going to
yeah.
find
market.
Yeah,
somehow
going
to
find
it,
right?
but rates started to shoot up again in the 1930s. We saw rates go up. 1940s, the World War II. 1939 to 1945, World War II, the top rate in 1942 was 88%, and the top bracket dropped dramatically from 5 million to 200,000.
Keep in mind, usually when those brackets change that radically, when they go up that much, there's also a change in what's deductible.
Yes, absolutely.
So the bottom line impact is never what it seems like.
Right.
No one's taxes went up by 400%.
No.
I'm sure.
No,
I'm sure it was a big increase.
That's a great point. That's
probably
a great
chunky,
point.
But it wasn't quite what it sounds.
Yeah,
you know?
We're strictly just talking about
yeah,
you know, the brackets themselves. We're not. It'd be too much. Too.
But again, today, folks, big mistake to think your vast majority of you will be in the same bracket when you retire as when you were working.
Very true.
Just the way things work out today, you know. So you're not being a lower bracket. I don't think that changes too much, you know. Used to be the adage, if you were in a lower bracket, you could do some tax planning around. Now, some people will be. Someone like me could be in a lower bracket of retirement because my career peaks late in my field generally. And then if you retire, and if you're a simple guy like me, when you are retired, you probably live pretty modestly. So it could happen to someone like myself. But for traditional employees and traditional jobs, I think it's almost not going to happen at all anymore.
I agree, especially if, I said, the new proposals go through and we go from seven brackets to three, and it even more increases that likelihood that you remain in the same tax bracket
right.
Now and then into retirement.
Hey, listen to this tidbit, folks. 5 years ago, gold hit $1,700 an ounce. It's $1,200 now. When it was at $1,700, I heard people on the radio, I heard people all over the place talking about this is going to $5,000. Whenever things seem crazy and people seem stupid over something, run away from it. This is a good example of it. Not against gold in general. I think it has its place. Very defensive thing. No dividend. Can have great periods of no performance at all. I would try to find something else other than gold to be a hedge against inflation, things of that nature. If you know that a terrible disaster is coming and the rest of us don't know, like war or weather, then buy gold. Because that's once the news is out, it's built into the price. I suspect as well right now the value of the S&P 500, this tax change is built in. It's expected. I believe that's true.
I would think so. Most of it.
Baked in. Most of it is.
Yeah, I mean, think about it.
When only something that shocks us should push the market higher because of these facts. I believe most of it's already there.
Yeah, well, I mean, when Trump was elected, we saw a big increase in the market before he was even inaugurated. Exactly. You know, so obviously, obviously, he didn't do anything yet of substance. So.
Well, it is absolutely true that markets tend to anticipate.
Right.
Not always, though. I've made a few moves in my career, son, that way, and it didn't anticipate. So it's, nothing is, as you know, in our field.
No, nothing 100%.
Nothing's lockstep. We deal in likelihoods. What is the likelihood? You know, it's odds. It's very math-like. I heard someone say once a while back, someone who was either not very aware of what investing really is, in my opinion, or hopefully they didn't get hurt. That would make them say things like that, too. They said to me, I would never invest ever my money. I have it all in the bank. I met someone somewhere else socially who said that to me. And he said, it's like gambling. And I said, really? I said, I have a chart on the wall of my office that goes back 80 years of the U.S. stock market. 12 times it fell in price. And all 12, it has a 12-0 record of full recovery. I don't. Why would you call that, a high risk investment? If you could go to the dog track and get those odds, 12 every single time. If you wait long enough, you'll win. You wouldn't. So I don't think it's gambling. I think the people you've heard talk about it that way. They speculated, Nathan, on individual stocks and did crazy things that no one would normally recommend they do.
That's when you say investing is gambling. I mean, investing is a very vague word. What do you mean?
And that's my point. Speculating is very much like gambling.
Right, yeah, yeah. I think
right. But investing in the market in general in your 401k plan is not. So if that's your perception of it, I would hope that you could get some knowledge or some reading to. Because that's a big mistake. Hey, thanks again, Nate. Great job on our taxes and history tonight. Tune in tomorrow night for the Money Talk Show and Don Sower, of course, right here on AM 790, your station for talk and business.